everybody. You're listening to Three Guys and a Data Model. And today around the table we have...
Sonia.
Jacob.
And Dave.
And I'm Taylor. So today's topic is why data model? But before we get into that, we should probably break this down into the basics and ask the question, what is a data model?
It's a good question to start with. And I know over the past several podcasts, you know, we've talked about it, but it's definitely important to kind of come back to the core of what it is and really sets a framework for kind of answering that question of why we're doing it and first understand what we're actually doing. So when we talk about a data model, we say, what is a data model? Really what we're doing is we're saying, how do you take data? How do you take structures? How do you take real world things and describe those and kind of document those in a way that a computer can actually understand them? As we as humans, we can talk about things in our environment and we can talk about various different topics, and we generally have an understanding of what those things are. We at least come in with it with a certain amount of understanding before we even start the conversation, where computers really don't have that. Computers have a little bit of a different problem in that you need to tell them exactly what everything is every time you talk to them or when they talk to each other. So when we say a data model, what we're doing is we're putting a structure around how you describe real world things in their environment. And not only what those things are, but also kind of how they relate to each other. There's various different examples, and obviously when we talk about specific data models in our world, you know, we'll talk about things because we're in the defense industry with a lot of things related to defense, whether it be your aircraft or control systems and things like that. But even if we abstract that out a little bit further and talk about maybe some things that are more real world for everyday kind of people, is that if you think about like a car is constructed of various different components within it. It has an engine, it has an interior, it has an exterior, it has tires, it has all these different things. And when we say car, when I'm having a conversation talking about a car, we generally know what that is. But to a computer, we really need to understand exactly what a car is. And that car may be composed of an engine, it may be composed of tires, it may be composed of that interior. And you can kind of get to different levels of descriptions talking about those different pieces. But then there's also things that cars relate to. So for example, a highway system. So a highway system has roads, it has signs, it has various different things that talk about a highway system. So in our data models, we're going to talk about each of those things. We're going to talk about cars, we're going to talk about engines, and we're going to talk about interiors and tires. And in highways, we're going to talk about the way roads are and maybe the material type and bridges and signs, and we're going to describe all that. But also in that data model, we're going to talk about how those things interact with each other. So those cars are actually going to interact with that highway system. If we add another layer, you know, humans themselves, you know, we are entities also that have to be modeled as well. What are we as humans? Okay, we have certain heights, we have certain characteristics about us, and we interact with the cars, and we also interact with the highway system. So as we look at a data model, like what is a data model? It's taking all of those pieces of information, describing them as much detail as we possibly can, and then describing how they interact with each other. If we can do that, if we can really truly describe all those things in great detail, that's when a computer can now suddenly start understanding how those are going to interact with each other. Again, we've talked about this in several other different podcasts, and definitely encourage to kind of go back and look at those, but at least that sets up kind of a framework for what we're going to talk about, I think, today.
Now that we know what a data model is, the next question is, what problems does data modeling solve?
Yeah, so, you know, to Dave's point, he said, you know, well, we really need to know exactly what a car is, right? And he explained the reason, you know, the reason why we need to document it at such a level is so that a machine can understand it. But why? Why do we want a machine to be able to understand what a car is and the components of a car, or what a human is and the components of a human, or the highway, bridges, etc.? If we think about, I'm going to explain kind of what a system of systems is, because generally when we're talking about data modeling, we're talking about getting a lot of benefit out of modeling a system of systems. So a system of systems is essentially multiple heterogeneous, distributed, occasionally independent operating systems that are embedded in a network at various different levels. So what does that mean? So for instance, let's think about a city. Right, so a smart city where ideally we're going to have all different kinds of domains kind of integrated together. So we're looking at like the power grid and the water system and the traffic system and parking and public safety, disaster response. Each individual one of those, like if we think about a power grid, it itself is a system of systems. There are lots of heterogeneous components, lots of different systems, different softwares, different devices, actuators that are working within that power grid system that need to be able to communicate with one another. At an even greater level, a smart city, if you're going to have cross-domain communication, so I want to be able to have my power system speak to my emergency response so that if there's a water main break, right? So water main break, I want to be able to automatically turn the power off to that section of the city, for instance. You wouldn't be able to have that happen. Then we're now talking about individual system of systems, power, water, public safety, also communicating. So it's an even bigger system of systems, right? So these kinds of things get really, really complicated when it comes to how do we make so many different devices and softwares and applications and systems speak to one another so that they can actually be understood by a computer and be able to communicate that way. Because of the very nature of a system of systems, it makes integration one of the biggest challenges. If we think about how integrations are traditionally done right now, they aren't done on such a mass scale, not very commonly, because of this challenge. So think about the way that they're commonly done. A lot of times we'll throw a bunch of developers at an integration work. We say, we need to make these five devices talk to one another. So we throw a bunch of developers at it, they sit around and they produce some very, very detailed documentation. They handwrite an awful lot of integration code. That takes a lot of money and a lot of time. Also, by the very nature of system of systems, they evolve over time. So once that work is done, it now needs to be maintained and needs to be kept up over time as the systems change, right? We certainly don't want the power system to just sit there and you know, not change over time, not be able to handle new loads or new neighborhoods or, you know, etc.
So what you're saying is kind of like, you know, you throw out the problem at a developer and the developer has to sit and look at each of those systems, understand each of the systems, try to understand what the programmer was thinking when they developed the system, and then they need to write some code to talk to another system, specifically only on what they know, but like you just said, something might change.
Yeah, so they have to go back and they have to go and do it all again.
Right. Exactly, right. They have to relearn that system that somebody else had made.
Except next year it's a different guy doing it.
Yeah.
So it takes the same amount of time again or longer.
Yeah.
And so that's exactly what a data model does, is it comes in and it says, well, rather than having to look at the code of, you know, being produced from this system and the code being produced by this system and me just wiring up those two codes, instead we create a data model which helps us, you know, to what Dave was saying earlier, it helps us to provide information at a very, very detailed level to the computer that says, this is what the car is all about. Mm-hmm. This is what, you know, the traffic lights are all about. And let's have the cars automated, you know, let's say the autonomous cars communicate with the traffic system without having to know every individual type of car, who's producing it, the different languages that are, you know, and the different data that's being produced by each of the devices on the car, and the same for the traffic system.
So even though something might change, like some system might develop, you're still talking about a car, you're still talking, now the system might change some inside of the specific details, but now you're still looking at that single source that everybody's talking about, looking at the same types of information at
the same time. Right, the same data model. And then that data model enables the ability. So that data model, basically, it doesn't do anything except help the computers understand the kind of content that they're talking about, the kind of data they're talking about, but it enables automated mediation and integration. Mm-hmm. And that's what we really want to get to, where now, because the data model enables the understanding of what the car is talking about, the traffic system's talking about, so that they can communicate with one another, but then it actually enables them to be communicating or to integrate those systems and to manage the integration of those systems over time as they change, so that, like, to Jacob's point, we don't have a new programmer sitting there next year going, I don't know what this is.
Yeah,
because everything is documented at such a level that it's very clear, and you can automatically upgrade the system or add on to it very quickly.
Well, and I can imagine, you know, when we start thinking about that, and we're saying, okay, well, now we're looking at a single data model. Everybody's trying to look at the same data model. They're writing software against the same data model, which I guess is all well and good. But then I guess there's that challenge of how do you describe the same piece of information in your data model differently? Like even though we're talking about an engine, you know, like in the data model, there might be an engine. It's kind of I guess then there's like a little bit of a challenge of, well, how do you know what that engine's to? You know, like I know at least, you know, in kind of the old way, it's like, well, I know I'm writing software for a car, so when I'm talking about a car, it's always the car's engine. But when you talk about just data, it probably makes it a little bit more difficult to talk about like a car's engine, because you're really just talking about engines, you know, for that.
Jet engine, car engine, is right. A scooter engine.
Yeah. Right. So, like, in a lot of ways, the data model itself can handle what I'll say is, you know, kind of the syntax, you know, of the engine, right? You're talking about an engine. The engine has a certain size. It has a certain compression. It has a certain temperature, those types of things. But what's cool about the data models when they're structured correctly, when you have these relationships, you also capture the actual semantic of that those entities as well. Because then you can really specify in your data model, because you have cars modeled and maybe you have planes modeled and you have engines modeled. Well, now you can kind of use that data model to leverage and know which of that you're talking about, which engine you're talking about. You just don't talk about engines. You talk about, oh, it's the engine that's in a car, or it's an engine that's in a plane. But still, you can talk about engines in general, you know, with it. So,
and actually that goes back to, I want to bring up a point that anybody who's listening to this and hasn't listened to our episode 5 on the IDML, the interface definition, interface documentation maturity levels, it might be helpful to go read that too, because we're talking about, you know, starting off with very, very basic, you know, programming code, then moving to things like ICDs and IDDs, interface control documents. But when Dave is saying, you know, a properly constructed data model, and he's talking about semantics, that is more what we consider in the IDML a more advanced level data model. Not always necessary to have an advanced data model, but in these really large systems like we're talking about, it does become necessary.
Well, so. Especially when you're talking, well, and to your point, you know, systems of systems, they could be disparate systems, you know, like systems that really don't have anything to do with each other. You know, when you're talking in the defense world and you're writing software for, you know, planes, like a specific kind of planes, you're kind of all know you're kind of talking about the same types of things. But when you have these larger systems of systems, even if we go back to kind of like the highway and like cars, you know, your data model around highways, you're all talking about highways. You're in that world. That's kind of where your worldview is, which is very different from a car's world. So you can't, the highway can't make any assumptions about a car, because it doesn't know, are you talking about a car? Are you talking about a truck? Are you talking about a motorcycle? You know, type of thing. So, but being able to document those semantics, being able to specify, you know, in your data model that, oh no, there's a specific ways that you can talk about very specific information. That highway can now understand what kind of thing you're talking about, because all the context and the semantic around those things that you're describing are actually characterized.
Jacob, this next question is for you. What does a data model look like?
So Dave's been talking about like how we store all these things, and or rather that we store all these things. And so the data model is kind of the how we store it. So there's a lot of different types of it. I mean, there's UCS, there's FACE, there's, I'm sure, 3 or 4 that I haven't heard of. But they're all different ways of storing mostly the same data. Some pieces, some ways store some more pieces than others, but they all kind of have a common theme as to how they're constructed, and that's that they have to codify assumptions. And so each time you come up against an assumption, you have to build a piece of your data model in order to make that unambiguous, right? So there, we have 3 levels in the FACE data model, which is kind of the main one that we use. And so that's the conceptual, the logical, and the platform. So the platform kind of handles like the baseline assumptions, like I'm going to use an integer for this. You know, I'm going to use a long or a double or a string to transmit this data. So it's very like low level stuff. And then the next level up is kind of how I'm gonna measure that. So I know that this is a double, but I'm actually talking about meters here, or I'm talking about temperature in Fahrenheit or something like that. And so that gives you more of your units and your measurement systems that encompass those. So it lets you translate between, you know, you're still talking about kind of the same thing, you're just talking about it with different units and maybe a different platform type, right? So we know how to translate between Celsius and Fahrenheit, and we know how to translate between a double and a float. So how do we, if we codify those assumptions, then it lets us do that change. And then how you know you're actually talking about the same thing is the conceptual level. So that brings in your, we call them observables. And so it's the fundamental properties of the universe, basically, from an engineering standpoint. any physicists, don't get mad at me.
Right.
But, so those are things like distance or temperature or position, right? Just overall ideas and concepts that you're talking about, hence conceptual level. And then you use those to compose entities, like Dave was saying. You know, if you have like an engine and that's the lowest level entity you want to go to, then an engine probably has a temperature. Everybody has it on their dashboard, right? And it probably has a rotational velocity, right, which is how many RPMs the engine is turning at, and things like that. And so it's various different observables compose the entity, and then you build out more and more entities from that, right? A car has an engine. And so it's kind of like class structure in object-oriented design, but it's a little bit different. So that's kind of the overall structure of the model. And like I said, you build each of those pieces so that you have the ability to make an assumption unambiguous. Whenever you run into something where the programmer that's building the system goes, oh, well, okay, this is going to be a double. You know, I know it's going to be a double, and so I'm sending a double here, and I'm just going to assume it's a double on the other side. Anywhere that you do that, you have to write it down in a way that a computer can read. Otherwise, you're not going to have automated integration. You're going to run into problems there. Because while you and I can very clearly be like, oh, yeah, oh, well, it's just Celsius and Fahrenheit. Yeah, that's obvious. You know, Silicon is not quite as discerning as we are.
And that puts us right back to humans having to write the integration code. And then whenever an update's made, humans having to rewrite the integration code.
Right.
Right. So the point of all of this with the data modeling is to get to that place where we can automate the integration. So that if we have 999 devices or systems communicating with one another, that we add one more, we don't have to write 999 pieces of code. We don't have to have somebody, a bunch of people sitting around writing those 999 pieces of code to make everything talk to one another. That instead, we can do some configuration in that new device, and then automatically generate all of the code that's needed.
Yeah.
Pretty much near instantaneously.
And that's really the beauty of having, like Jacob was describing, you know, the conceptual logical platform. There's levels of abstraction, right? You know, there's levels of distinction between those. It starts allowing that interoperability. Because even though you may be talking about, you know, your engine temperature in Celsius as a double, and I'm talking about my engine temperature in Fahrenheit, you know, as an N, we can still get to one or the other, because now we know, oh, okay, at the platform level, we're talking the difference between, you know, the integer and the double, and at that logical level, oh, there's a difference, you know, there's one's talking about Celsius, one's talking about Fahrenheit. I don't necessarily need to know you're talking in Celsius just because I'm talking in Fahrenheit. The model itself actually shows that there's a connection between the two, because at the conceptual level, those both come back to a single thing called a temperature. So now we have like a way to get from one to the other, and that automation starts really being possible.
So let's go in a different direction for a second. What are the costs associated with data modeling?
Data modeling is definitely not a one and done kind of situation. So there is a lot of work up front, you know, in terms of the actual modeling work to be done. There's a lot of really rigorous, unambiguous documentation that needs to take place of the universe of the system of systems. But from there, once that data model is created, there is a maintenance mode that it goes into. You know, as we mentioned, you know, things change. We want to be able to bring in a new system and add it to the ecosystem, the overall ecosystem. We want to be able to upgrade something. We want to be able to talk. You know, we've got new features that have been added, so we want to be able to talk about new things. So it needs to be maintained, and that's very, very important, because right now, the way that more early and mid-level data models have been created, and we talk about that again in our IDML episode, a lot of those models, because they are so difficult to maintain, because they aren't necessarily semantically enabled, and they aren't necessarily kind of what we call very highly connected at various levels, like we're talking about with what Dave and Jacob were just talking about, it's very, very difficult to maintain, and so a lot of times those data models get dropped once, and then that's it. They're forgotten. And that's a lot of time and money that's gone into that, where there's no benefit coming out of it over the long haul. So it's very important to realize that the data modeling effort is big at first and then declines dramatically. So you also find your costs sort of follow that. The cost is greater the start of the effort, but then so much time and financial savings in the long run in terms of integration costs. Just dramatically less. Because like I said, we're talking about the difference between something that might normally take weeks or months to document and create integration code. Once the documentation's done in the model, it can be seconds to create the integration code for something that would normally take months.
Yeah. Like you said, I do kind of joke a lot of times, so it's like, oh, when is ever a data model done, right? And really, because it comes down to that specificity of what you want to really start documenting. So there is that ongoing maintenance, like as Sonia was saying, of being able to expand and get more specific with your data model, but at the same time, that starts allowing you to leverage all that new detail in new ways. So you're the acceleration and the exponential speed and that you can get to those integration of those more specifics of your data model is just rapidly, increase that speed for it. But when you look at your data model itself, you have your, as you start defining it more and more, you may, for example, start just, okay, this is a house, that house, if you can imagine almost like you're building a house out of just wooden blocks, as a kid, you're building like this house out of wooden blocks, and then you kind of upgrade to like Legos, and now you can do all these more things, now create new structures because now you have Legos, and now as you start, going up, now, oh, I can actually build these things out of wood, and an architect can actually start creating these elaborate types of things. So as you kind of build out that model, you're able to do that much more with it.
So our final question today is, how does one start creating a robust data model? But my question is, what does the term robust mean?
So robustness of a data model is, well, it's kind of it's an ongoing debate, I guess. The ultimate measure of truth is how well it facilitates integration. If you're able to integrate two pieces seamlessly, then you have a very good data model, right? If it takes, 2 months to get those systems ready to integrate, that's still pretty good.
Okay.
It's not bad, right? If it takes 5 years and 500 people, you probably have a pretty bad data model, right? So that's kind of the ultimate measure of truth. There are some metrics you can apply to the data model that show how useful it will be, but ultimately the true measure is how well it helps you integrate stuff.
So robust is synonymous with like efficient, maybe?
Yeah, robustness and usefulness, I guess.
Yeah,
kind of go together.
Maybe even like the flexibility and scalability.
Yeah.
And even that level, and back to what Sonia was mentioning about the IDML session or podcast that we did a couple podcasts ago, determining what that level of robustness that you need, for your specific program. You may only need a very minimal kind of level, but you may need a very advanced level.
Right.
And as your system grows, you're going to have to need that more and more robustness to really be more integratable with other systems.
Right.
But I think Jacob's absolutely correct. Like the ultimate, measure is the integratability.
Yeah.
Okay, so how does one start creating this robust data model?
So as Sonia said, it's kind of a large upfront cost, right? You're to start building your data model is somewhat intimidating. So there's kind of two pieces, especially from scratch, right? There's kind of two pieces to creating a data model, or at least mapping your system against it. So there's the creation of entities and associations and things like that we talked about before, but then there's also mapping your messages against it. So it's saying that I've built out this large and complex structure, and now I want to say that in my message I'm talking about this one piece of that structure. So those two things usually happen in tandem as you're going, and that's kind of the right way of doing it. But those two pieces one of them gets easier, the other one doesn't necessarily get easier. So for the first system that you build, with the data model, you build out all the entities and you build this huge structure, and then you map all the messages against it, and it takes a long time and it's difficult, but you can do it. So you get through that. Then the second system comes along and they want to map against the same data model, and this lets you leverage a large amount of work that's already been done. Are you going to have everything that you need in there? probably not, but, you know, at a conservative estimate, let's say you get 20% of the stuff that you want to map is already in the data model. That's a big savings, you know. And then the third system that comes along, they're going to have, you know, 30-40% of what they wanted is already in the data model to map their messages against it. And so you're lowering the one piece of model building, the entity creation and associations and stuff like that. You're lowering the amount of that you have to do, and you're left with just the amount that is mapping your messages against it. So really, that cost, if you want to do it of like cost per mapping, for the first system, it's going to be pretty high. For the, you know, 15th, you're way, way lower. It's like a reverse exponential graph.
And then, of course, if you can leverage off of an existing model, like that,
right.
that we use, you know, some incredibly large models that we've built out over the last number of years that already encompass a lot of, you know, the UAV, the airspace domains, the, you know, we've got command and control. You know, there's an awful lot that's already in there, so you know.
Well, and then there's different ways of looking at getting started on it as well, and like the amount of effort that's there. There's the actual content itself. So there's the content that you want to be talking about. So whether it be the air vehicles or the air domain or cars or highways or houses or what have you. There's that content piece, and that can get hard because, like we said, we can get down to really almost an unlimited amount of detail and granularity to talk about those things. So that can be very high. And we can talk about all different ways to talk about that data. But then there's the other kind of side of it is really just how do you practically go about doing it, right? How do you actually touch the model? How do you actually start defining these things? And this really gets back to that tooling aspect. You know, how can you, you know, you're not just going to take this huge, you know, schema or text file and try to do this. It's how do you, you know, there should be ways to have an easier way to interface with that model itself and be able to add things or change things and document these things, right?
Tooling makes a very large difference in how you build,
especially
tooling
like built specifically for data modeling.
Exactly.
You know, data modeling we're talking about.
And so that's what the, you know, our flagship product Phenom does, is it is specifically built for data modeling. And, you know, that means the data modeler can model, but also we're working on wizards to make it easier for even non-data modelers to get in there and model all the stuff to the same degree, the same rigorous requirements, unambiguous level that that a professional data modeler would do it, and in the past has done it, you know, by hand or, you know, essentially diagramming and building it out that way.
There's a lot of different pieces of information to keep together, and if you can expose the user to only the ones that they're the expert in and that they have to put in, then you drastically decrease your amount of effort. So that's what we're trying to hit with that.
Everybody listening, thank you so much for joining us. For more information about data modeling or IDML, please visit our website at www.scale.com. That's S-K-A-Y-L. And we'll see you all on episode 8.